Okay. The Koan today, so Raf's Koan pick chapter 19 from the Denkoroku. It's a bit of a long one. The actual Koan is, or the actual case of the Koan is quite small, but the background and the Teisho, which we're going to look at from Kaizen, is what really makes it quite interesting. So the Denkoroku is the book, the fourth book that we study in our Koan curriculum, and basically it entails 53 cases that trace the lineage of the Zen ancestors all the way from Chakamuni Buddha all the way to Kaizen himself. Kaizen would have been the 54th ancestor, but due to some humility he decided to stop at one before him. So what he did was he looked at what was the actual transmission of light, or that's what Denkoroku means, transmission of light. So what was the actual experience that each successive ancestor had, all up to the point where he was writing it all down. So he basically documented the lineage. Now, please don't take everything literally. This is not meant to be taken literally. Like, you can wonder how can someone in, he wrote this in the year 1300. How can he know what happened, you know, to the second or third ancestor in India going back over 2,500 years ago, especially given that there were no written records in those days until about 200 or 300 years after the Buddha. But nevertheless, records were kept to some degree, and of course a lot of it is anecdotal, and so it's not meant to be a literal transmission. Nevertheless, it makes it very, this whole book is very interesting. I find it to be one of the most profound Koan books that exists, especially Kaizen's verses, which we're going to look at in a minute. So Kaizen is, he was a successor of Dogen, and he's the one that wrote it down. So we're starting off with chapter 19, the 19th patriarch, Venerable Kumurata. The case. The 19th patriarch, Venerable Kumurata. Once the Venerable Kayashata, so he would have been the 18th patriarch, so once the Venerable Kayashata, while instructing the 19th patriarch, said, "Long time ago, the world honored one," so that's Buddha, so the world honored one, wrote, "1,000 years after my passing, a great personage will appear in the land of Geshe," which is northern India, "and will make the profound teaching flourish. Now you have met me, and it corresponds to that auspicious fortune." Hearing this, the master Kuramota, so the 19th, was aroused to the wisdom of former lives. Okay, hearing this, the master was aroused to the wisdom of former lives. So first of all, just to put it in a little bit of different language, was aroused to the wisdom of former lives. What does that mean? We're going to go into that in a bit more detail. But another way of looking at that is he was aroused. He was, in other words, he realized mu. He realized what former life, what that all means. You know, he realized karma, or he transcended his own karma. These are all different ways of looking at it. James gave me something to read. It's quite a small little book the other day, and I just glanced at it, and this is. This is a student from Hakuen Roshi wrote this. So Hakuen, some of you that go to Sesshin may remember Hakuen Roshi, Song of Zazen. So one of his students wrote this book. And there's a commentary here as well. The commentary is actually much longer than this guy wrote. So I just want to read you, the first thing here, I just want to read you a few things which are quite interesting. And it relates to this koan to some degree. Okay, let me see where we are. So Torai was the student. And he wrote this So this was written roughly in the 1700s. Okay, he wrote this. When the all-enlightened, world-honored one came into the world, he did seven steps to indicate the four directions and one hand pointing to heaven and one to earth. So quite often we see a Buddha statue with this, a Buddha statue with the Buddha pointing to heaven and to earth. Uttered the lion's roar. So he uttered the lion's roar. Between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. Bah! He just let out his breath. So between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. So here, I alone am the honored one, as I explained many times before, is not I as in I am the honored one, please revere me. It is he only sees one existence, one total existence, and that is what he's referring to, I alone. There's no separation between, there's no me and other, there's just I alone. So that's what he means by that. I alone am the honored one. In other words, he realized not self. He just realized I alone, there's just whatever it is, you know, one existence. Okay, so he said, so this is, according to Zen, this is one of the first things that the Buddha said. Now, Unmon, famous Zen master, commented on I alone am the world honored one. So he commented on this. So this is now a Chinese, so this is goes back more than 1,500 years after the Buddha was born. He commented on this, Unmon. And he said, if I had been there, I would have beaten him to death with a stick and fed him to the dogs. That's what he said. Peace would then have restored to the world. Now he goes on. Master Owen, I don't know who Master Owen is, also took this up and said, when the Buddha was born, he brought with him a hideous poison. When Unmon came up against it, he recognized the symptoms and handled it right. Okay. And it goes on. Leaving it at that, however, there would be no Buddha Dharma. So in other words, if Unmon would have beaten him to death, there would have been no Dharma, there would have been no teachings. So the Buddha set up signposts, such as his leaving home, he's practicing austerities, again entering the snowing mountains and just sitting for 6 years. Suddenly, one night, the great awakening took place, and deeply moved, he exclaimed, oh, how wonderful all living beings have been, all living beings have the totality of the Tathagata's wisdom. All living beings, or all phenomena, you could say, it doesn't even have to be living, all phenomena have the totality of the Tathagatas of Buddha's wisdom and virtue. And again, when a Buddha completes the way and the Dharmakaya stands revealed in the grasses, trees, countries, all are Buddha. That is all fine, but still a pity. He says, still a pity. So one more little thing out of this. The words, he says, the words cannot reach the Dharma gate teaching of this attainment, nor describe how it is to be tested. They are skillful means nevertheless, and as such are collected in the Flower Garland Sutra, or as such they are collected in the sutras. So what's he saying here? What's Unmon saying? He's saying, if I would have been there, I would have beaten him to death. Okay. So first of all, we got to look at this from a Zen perspective or from an ultimate perspective. So in Buddhism, there's always two perspectives. Some of you may have heard this before. Some of you, it may be the first time. So the two perspectives, one of them is the world of phenomena, the world of dualism, the world of me and you. And the other perspective is that perspective of totality. I alone, just that particular perspective. One way of looking at it is the perspective of the wave and the ocean. So the ocean is the ocean. We can all imagine the ocean. But then there's a wave, and then there's drops, and then there's bits of water that spring out of the ocean. Then, so we can look at it from the ocean perspective, Or we can look at it from the wave perspective, which is all the different forms. And there's millions of waves every day, up and down and small and short and fast and slow. There's so many different waves. But most of us look at Buddhism from the wave perspective. And when we look at Buddhism or Buddha or what the Buddha has taught from the waves perspective, all we see is confusion. That, you know, I just recently went across the, from the South Island mainland to Stewart Island. And you've got the Southern Ocean, you've got the Tasman Sea, and the Pacific Ocean, all converging. They call it the Confused Sea. That's what it is. It's a confused sea. So the waves come from everywhere. And you can imagine the boat. It just doesn't know where to go. A lot of people were throwing up, you know. It's a very confused sea. And it's a bit like that. When we look at Buddhism from the waves perspective, from Buddha's perspective, from Dharma perspective, from all these different teachings that are out there, it's confusing. So Unman is saying, if I would have been there, I would have beaten him to death. Meaning, no Buddha. Even forget the whole notion of Buddha. What's Buddha? There's nothing, there would be nothing there, and it would have been, peace would have reigned on earth. And all this confusion, all, what are we trying to get here? You know, all comes back from that first lion's roar. All comes back from the teaching, so to speak. But that's what Unman is saying, and so that's what the other teacher is saying as well. So coming to that, I just look at this teacher from that perspective. So in many ways, koans are there to entangle us in this world of phenomena. They entangle us. We look at it and go, oh my God, what is this? But the trick is to get to see clearly through it and to become untangled. So that's now the challenge, is to get untangled, even though there's a lot of tangling happening in this koan. Let's get untangled. Okay, that's what it's about. And in that sense, it's a skillful mean. Just like the skillful means, just like the teachings of the Buddha are also all considered a skillful means, but they're actually not it. They're just the teachings. So some people get hung up on teachings, and they study all the teachings, and they study all the teachings, and then once they studied all the teachings, then they pass on the teachings, and then they study all the teachings, and then they pass it on to the teachings. And so the teachings are being promulgated, but no one got it. So that's what the transmission of light is about, is to really see what it is. What is it all about? Okay. Within the entanglement of it all. So in many ways you could also say that the entanglement is like we're almost using logic to go against logic in many ways as well. Okay. So it starts off with the wisdom of former lives. I mean, we look at that word, the wisdom of former lives. You know, that already gets us going. What is the wisdom of former lives? You know. So, but anyway, the background is quite interesting. That gets right into the wisdom of former life. So the master, which is the 19th, so this is the one that is that we're talking about here. The master, this is the background. The master was from the land of Geshe, and his family name was Baramon Brahman. Long ago, when he was a heavenly being, in the Jizai Ten celestial realm of the Paranirmita Vashavartan, okay, so this is an Indian name, which is the sixth heaven in the realm of desire, he saw a bodhisattva's accessory made of precious stones and immediately felt attached to it. So if you look at this sheet here, so those of you on Zoom can't unfortunately see that. Maybe like that, I don't know. But anyway, it's a hierarchy of different realms. So that's all I can say. I won't get you to read it. It's not important. It's a hierarchy of different realms. And this is part of the Buddhism's teachings. Okay. And as I explained before with these hierarchies, you can look at it and take it literally, as in Indian mythology has it, that there are different realms out there. And depending on our karma, or depending on the merit that we've accumulated over different lifestyles, we are getting into different realms, or we are born in different realms. That's Buddhist mythology. And another way to look at that is that at any given moment, depending on our state of mind, we are entering those realms. So if I'm greedy, like this guy here, saying that He saw a precious stone of a bodhisattva. He felt attached to it. Wow, I'd love to have that precious stone. That immediately got him into the hungry ghost realm. Hungry ghost is the realm of desire. It's the realm of, you know, not being able to get out of that realm of desire. So you're stuck there until you free yourself of desire. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's very similar, as I keep on always saying. That hierarchy of needs of Maslow is based on a similar principle, that we need to fulfill certain needs in our lives in order to move up a notch. You know? So here you might have a need, for instance, for shelter or a need for food. Unless that need is met, you will not go to the next realm or to the next level of fulfillment, whatever you want to call it. And so we move up these different layers. And as I keep on saying, that can happen at any given moment. Right now, here we are coming to a beautiful Zendo on a Sunday afternoon. That's because we can do that simply because of conditions that have brought us here. And those conditions have actually got not that much to do with me, myself, but lots of conditions. The fact that we live in a peaceful country like Australia, and that we have someone like the Theosophical Society providing a building for us to do it, there are so many things that needed to happen for us to be here. If we would be in the Gaza right now, there's no way we could sit like this. You know, not just physically, but also mentally. Our needs would change from one day to the next. We would be back in the realm of survival. So these are the different needs. What's interesting about this one, you may want to have a look at that, is that it looks at the different schools of Buddhism. Like the first ones are the six realms of samsara, or the six realms of desire, if you like. But then it goes into, you know, what the different higher stages are, and that depends on which school you follow. Like there are different schools in Buddhism that look at it in different ways. But what is interesting is that on this side here, you know, to go from the lowest level, which is the hungry ghost, the hell level, to the highest, which is the Buddha level, it has this lovely spiral that goes upwards. And that spiral has got two explanations. One says sudden enlightenment, and the other one says gradual enlightenment. And this sudden enlightenment part is this, you know, this untangling of the karmic seeds, this confusion that we have. So this gradual untangling happens, of course, but we can also experience sudden awakening, in the sense that all of a sudden we see it, you know. And at that moment, no matter where we are on the gradual path, at that moment we leap up. We have this glimpse of what it is actually like. We see this totality of everything. We can taste, I alone am the honored one. We see exactly what previous Buddhas and previous enlightened beings have seen. It doesn't even have to be Buddhas, you know. So this is quite interesting, the way this whoever made this made this sketch, the way that is drawn is quite interesting. So we go from a dusty spot to a semi-dusty, so to realize that there is the phenomenal world and the essential world, if you like, the wave and the ocean, so we still have the two, to all of a sudden go higher and higher and higher and higher in our, as far as our consciousness is concerned. So that's quite interesting as well. Okay, just keeping going on this. So the master was from the land of Geshe, and his family name was Brahman. Long ago, when he was a heavenly being, so he was already at a heavenly realm, the sixth heaven in the realm of desire, so he was right up there already, he saw a bodhisattva's accessory made of precious stones and immediately felt attached to it. And because of this, he fell from that realm and was born in the Toriten celestial realm of the second heaven in the realm of desire. Straight away down. He heard then Indra's preaching the Hanya Haramita. We're going to chant that this afternoon. The Hanya Haramita. the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and thanks to its superiority, he ascended to Hanten, the celestial realm of the Brahma Devas, in the realm of phenomena. So he went up a notch again. So he went down and then he went up, depending on his state of mind. Being quite bright, he was skillful in preaching the essentials of the Dharma, and the heavenly beings esteemed him by making him their teacher. Okay. So they made him their teacher because he all of a sudden saw through some of it, and they made him their teacher. Now, that the time had come to succeeding to the rank of the patriarchs, he finally descended from the celestial realm and was born in Geshe. So finally then, after all of this, he was born in northern India in Geshe. Okay. So this is when he was born there, that was where the koan is, in Geshe. The 18th patriarch, the 18th patriarch was obviously there before the 19th one, while preaching and saving people, arrived in Geshe. Seeing a strange key, spiritual energy around a certain Brahmin house, he was about to enter it. So he saw this strange energy, he saw this sort of this light, whatever. Our imagination can go wild here. He saw this strange energy like in the temple or whatever. And he thought, I'm going to go in there. He goes in there. And then the master, so this is the 19th patriarch, appeared and asked him, what kind of group of followers are you? He said, what kind of group of followers are you? And Kayashata, the 18th, replied, we are followers of the Buddha. We are followers of the Buddha. And when the master, so the 19th patriarch, heard the name Buddha, he was awe-stricken and shut the door. The venerable Kayashata, which is the 18th patriarch, was silent for a while and then knocked on the door. The master, so 19th patriarch, said, there is no one in the house. He knocked on, so there's no one in the house, no one here. Okay. So when you hear that in Zen, where there's no one in the house, so you can look at that as, what's he saying? Like, I don't want to see you, there's no one here. But from a Zen perspective, there's no one in the house. Meaning that he's already seen through me. He's already seen through that. There's no one here. There's no one actually here. So it's a test, he's saying to him. There's no one here. The venerable 18th replied, who is it that says there's no one here? So there's a challenge. Who is it that says that there is no one here? And when the master heard that, he realized that this was an unusual person. He quickly opened the door and ushered him in. And the venerable Kayashapa, the 18th, once told him. And now we are getting to the... So this was all background to the koan. Now we are getting to the koan. So at that moment, he said to him, long time ago, the world-honored one wrote, 1,000 years after my passing, a great personage will appear in the land of Genshi, northern India, and will make the profound teaching flourish. Now you have met me, and it corresponds to that auspicious fortune. Hearing this, the master was aroused to the wisdom of former lives. So this is when the koan starts. Now, Kaizen, so he looked at that background, I don't know where he got that background from, and this is, of course, very convoluted, and it mixes up all sorts of mythologies and all of this, but we've got to be able to see through all of that. But he takes this case now on, and he wrote a teisho. Okay, so we're going to go through that teisho. So he says, you should look into the story minutely. So first, you should look into the story minutely. What does that mean? Looking into the story minutely, means, to me anyway, it means to look at the story critically. Yeah. Don't just brush it aside. Look at this, there's something to be had here, even to us modern people. You know, there is something to be had here. Look at the story minutely. Look at it critically and examine it. Even if you clarify the philosophical way of names and words, keep in mind, he wrote this in the year 1300, okay? So the language is always a little bit different than it is today. So he says, even if you clarify the philosophical way of names and words, and you clarify that coming and going, as well as birth and death, are the substance of the true person, if you do not clarify the fact that your own intrinsic nature is empty and clear, marvelous and vast, you do not understand what all Buddhas have witnessed. So he's saying, even if you clarify coming and going, and you heard me talk about coming and going, life and death many times on many teshos, coming, what is coming, what is going? Now, of course, from the wave perspective, the wave is coming and the wave is going. The wave is high and the wave is low. And the wave is turbulent and the wave is relaxed. Or whichever way you want to describe the wave, you know. So even if you clarify that, even if you clarify that, and death, the wave comes up and it's alive, then it's died. Where is it? Where's the wave? So even if you clarify life and death, life comes up, and death goes. It goes. Where is it? It's gone. Where did it go? It comes up and it goes. Where did it go? Even if we clarify that, if you clarify that that is the substance of the true person. So that word substance, again, is an odd word. It's the substance of the true person. I like to change that word to it's the function of the true person. We function that way. Even our thinking is along that. We think that way. We think of high and low and dying and living and green and blue. We function that way. We cannot but function that way. It's the same as the waves. You know, they function that way. So even if we clarify that, we need to clarify that. You know. And of course, we clarify that through Mu, being able to see what Mu is about. And once we get a grasp of what Mu is about, we get a grasp of what the ocean is about. And then we can see the functioning. So even, he says, even if you grasp it, or clarify it. If you do not clarify the fact that your own intrinsic nature is empty and clear, marvelous and vast, you do not understand what all Buddhas have witnessed. So if you do not clarify what the ocean is, then you have not witnessed what the Buddhas and other enlightened people have witnessed. We need to clarify what the ocean is. But we get stuck in the phenomena of the waves and the turbulence that comes with it. That is why you are so amazed, he goes on, to see Bodhisattva emitting light. Oh, all this stuff. Oh my God, there's a light happening. Oh, that was meant to be. And these different lights have different meaning, and maybe it means this and that, and I should really go there or here, all this stuff. That is why you are so amazed to see Bodhisattvas emitting light and feel attached when you see the wonderful figures of all Buddhas. So we see these beautiful Buddhas and we feel attached to it. Or if we're Christians, we see these wonderful statues and we get attached to that. So Buddhas and lights, and these are symbols. So these are symbols that we create, archetypes even, you know, angels and gods and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arahants. These are all archetypes. These are all symbols that we create. You know. And so that's what he's saying. We create them. The texts, even the Dharma, that's why Udenmond said, you know, I would have beaten him to death, because even the Dharma is a symbol. It's a means for something, but it's not it. You know? Rituals is another one that we can attach to. That is why you're so amazed to see some rituals that we get attached to. That is why you are so amazed to see the bodhisattvas emitting light and feel attached when you see the wonderful figures of all the Buddhas. The reason is that you have not freed yourself. This is what Kaizen wrote in 1300. The reason we are attached to it is because we haven't freed ourselves. That's what he's saying. We haven't freed ourselves from the three poisons of greed, anger, and folly. So again, the greed, anger, and folly, the three poisons, I mean, we chanted here, you know, in Sangamon. You know, again, in Buddhism, these are called, you know, karmic hindrances. So if we, as long as we've got greed, there's still an I. It's impossible, if I have greed in me, to move beyond the I, because it keeps me locked in. You know, if I have hatred, that means that I don't like someone. If I don't like someone, that means there's likes and dislikes. It means that I'm right and that person is wrong. You know, I'm stuck there. And if I'm stuck there, then I am not free. I have not freed myself from that. Same with hatred. So this is the strongest form of self-referencing that we do. We are stuck in that subject-object duality. We're stuck in the duality. If I got greed or if I got hatred, there's someone else there that I've got hate towards. So that's what he's saying. The reason is that you have not yet freed yourself from the three poisons of greed, anger, and folly. So while they keep us trapped, we cannot go beyond it. While greed, hatred, and folly, greed, anger, and folly, you know, while that is there, we're trapped. Of course, another way we could say, and this is the gradual way, so looking at this schema here, the gradual way is to free ourselves bit by bit from greed, hatred, and folly. You know, that's the gradual way. But there is a way also where we can all of a sudden see in one instance who we are, like, you know, finding our true self. Where that is extinguished right there and then. Doesn't mean we can't fall back like this poor fella. He got attached and then he fell back in the realm. But we can get a glimpse of what it's like to move beyond that. And all of us that are sitting in meditation, in many ways we are doing that. You may remember the bucket analogy. When we sit and we just let it come and let it go. We come and let it go. And eventually, as we are practicing meditation, we enter a realm of, yes, it's coming and going, but we are no longer attached to it. We're no longer attached to the monkey mind. The monkey mind comes and it goes. Through all its, like, all of a sudden we enter into the depth of the ocean. While the sea is still out there causing havoc. And at that moment we get a glimpse, a sense of what it's like. It's sublimely peaceful when we're in that state. Because nothing can disturb us. So we get a sense of that, you know, of that, what it's like to experience just being the ocean. But for us to experience ocean, we need to let go of the I. By the way, that just happens. there's nothing we can do about it. That just happens through, you know, through our practice. When we now look at the past of the master, so the 19th, when we now look at the past of the master, okay, he regressed and fell into the celestial realms of the Tori Ten, so that hungry ghost realm, and because of his attachment, however, due to causes in former lives, so conditioning or merit, so again, if you look at it today, due to causes in former life, so we might all of a sudden practice, and we might be at that highest realm, then we let go of the practice, and all of a sudden we fall back into our bad habits, you know, and all of a sudden we fall back into that realm of being greedy, and we can't see the point, and things get a bit stressful, and then we come back again and we start meditating. So the conditions of former lives is nothing other than us having had a taste of meditation. That happened in the past. All of a sudden, I come back to meditation. So you can look at it that way. It doesn't have to be former lives as in before I was born. It's just in our lifetime. We build up merit, or to the degree that we build up merit, you know, is the degree to which we see through all of this. So, you know, you can look at merit from that perspective. So every time we sit, we're building merit. We're building up conditions for the seeds to flourish. We are cultivating the soil, is another way of looking at it. That is building merit. Okay. So, however, due to causes in former lives, he ascended to the realm of the Han Ten when he heard Indra preaching the Dharma, and finally he was born in Geshe. So all that sitting, all of a sudden you hear something, whether it's a sutra or a noise somewhere, all of a sudden that can just get you straight up, you know, into a different realm, an experience, maybe a Kensho experience. So accumulated merits and virtues from the past were not in vain. That's what he says. Finally, he met the 18th patriarch and was aroused to the wisdom of former lives. Aroused to the wisdom of former lives. Now Kaizen keeps going. He says, the so-called wisdom of former lives is considered to be the knowledge of the past and the future. Wow. I'll read that again. The so-called wisdom of former lives is considered to be the knowledge of the past and the future. Where's my pen? I always like to use the pen for this book. This is the past. I mean, that's incredible. The entire past is right here. I mean, you can look at it in small ways and say, well, this was written in 1300, or no, sorry, in 1700, whenever he wrote it, because he was Hakuin. But this is the past. Not just what is written here, but this actual book itself is the past. It wasn't created now, it's the past, you know. No matter what you look at, it's all past. Everything is past. And this is also the future. There is no past. When we intellectually know, there is no such thing as past. That is a concept, because we can, as humans, we can look at the concept of past and future, but actually there is no such thing. That is just in our mind. We can deduct that there was a past, because we have the ability to look at time and space and look at it from that perspective. So that's what it requires you, to see that is the past and this is the future. And it all comes together right now. Everything comes together right now. Past, future, it's just an illusion. That is what it means, being aroused to the former lives, being aroused to the former lives. You know, this here is all life. All life that has ever happened accumulates right here simultaneously. And of course, that is not something that can be explained from the perspective of the waves. You need to see the ocean when you see this. This is the entire ocean. Every wave is the entire ocean. There is no separate wave from the ocean, ever. Doesn't matter what wave you look at. If you look at the Pacific Ocean, I mean, look at how many waves there. You can never say that is separate to this. It's all at the same time, the ocean. At the same time. No past. It goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down. No future. Goes up, goes down. All ocean. All of this is ocean. That is what he was, he says, aroused to. That is what triggered him off. That was the trigger point. The so-called wisdom of the former lives is considered to be the knowledge of the past and the future. Everything coalesces in that right here, right now, at every given moment. You know, and I think that analogy with the wave and the ocean is pretty good. However, what would such knowledge be worth after all? So he's saying, even if you did have, and this is a big thing, the Buddha is said to have known everything that happened to everyone, future and past. But Kaizen is saying, even if you had such knowledge, what would it be worth? If you knew your past lives, if you knew your future life, well, so be it. So what? What would that be worth? You know, it's nothing. There's nothing special. It's nothing. You know, nothing to work towards. What would that be worth? You know, if you only see through that your original, unchanging self nature is neither holy nor ordinary. So seeing through our unchanging self nature means the ocean. Seeing through our unchanging self nature, beautifully put, the unchanging. So you've got, in one way, you've got impermanence in Buddhism, which is overrated. Impermanent as the waves. Of course it's impermanent, up and down and here and there. But seeing the unchanging nature, you know, that's the key. Seeing the unchanging nature is seeing the ocean. Seeing the unchanging nature. So it goes on. If you only see through that your original, unchanging self nature is neither holy or ordinary or deluded. So it's neither holy nor ordinary, nor high, not wet, not tall, not this, not that. The waves are neither that. They're all ocean. So if you see through that, you know, through this whole whatever it is that we're looking at moment by moment, then hundreds of thousands of Dharma gates, hundreds of thousands, an infinity amount of Dharma gates, like all the teachings, they're endless. Same as the waves. The waves are endless. Hundreds of thousands of Dharma gates equals the teachings. And incalculable numbers of mysterious teachings all abide in the source mind. Again, a funny word. All abide in the source mind. They all abide in the ocean. They all abide in the ocean. Therefore, both the topsy-turvy delusions of all living beings and the enlightenment of all Buddhas abide within a square inch of yourself. It all abides right here. If we let go, it all abides right here. He goes on, it is not at all the Dharma of the six roots, meaning the six senses, and six dusts. So the six roots and the six dusts, meaning the six senses, so eye is one sense, or seeing is one sense, and then the eye object is the root. So the dust. So I've got the root, which is seeing, and then an eye object might be that pillow over there. So that is the dust. It is not at all the Dharma of the six roots and the dusts, nor the dimension of mind and its surroundings, nor the dimension of mind and its surroundings. Subject, object. No, like mind, me, mind. I'm here, you're there. Mind, object. That's what this is meant there. At this point, what can be considered ancient and what can be considered present? So when you see that, what can really be considered ancient? Like ancient patriarchs or Buddhas or realms or what can be considered, when you see the ocean, what can be considered ancient? An ancient wave? It's an ancient wave. Oh, 1,000 years ago there was this wave. Yeah, told a good story. it told a wonderful story. And that's what we do. We're looking at it from that prism of all of these waves. Oh my God, how many waves there have been on this world. And all the wars and all the good stuff and the bad stuff, all the waves. At this point, what can be considered ancient and what can be considered present? Even that. What are all Buddhas and what are all living beings? He goes on. Not a single thing obstructs the eye. Nothing. There's nothing there. It's just ocean. Not a single thing. If I get attached to the wave, then it obstructs. I got the wave. I got all the concepts. I've got the high and the lows and the nicest and the bad stuff and the good stuff. I got all the waves out there, the rain and the sunshine. Yeah. Not a single thing obstructs the eye. Not a speck of dust touches the hands. It simply is a single entity of void. Clarity, one empty boundlessness. One empty boundlessness. Now, it's of course, we've got to be careful here that remember our functioning, the functioning aspect of our true self, the functioning aspect of the ocean are the waves. There's no doubt about it. So let's not, you know, it's not that all of a sudden the waves, there's no waves. The waves are there. That's the way we function in this world, is by surfing. We surf. That's what we do, you know. But we get so attached on that perfect wave or on that perfect teaching or on whatever it is that we don't see the ocean. So this is nothing but the eternal, truly perfected Tathagata. Nothing but all living beings intrinsically unobscured. So when you see that, when you see everything from the perspective of the ocean, nothing but all living beings intrinsically unobscured. Then you see through everything being unobscured. There, nothing increases. Even when we realize it that way, nothing decreases. Even when we don't understand it that way. So it's just understanding, not understanding, living, dying, all these things. Being enlightened and feel that it's been thus for eternal kalpas, in other words, forever. It's been like that forever. Beyond even when the earth was found. It's been like that. If we can see that it's beyond the earth, it's like what we normally we consider ourselves earthlings maybe or whatever. The entire existence is like that. So it is the entire existence, you know. Being enlightened and feel that it's been thus for eternal kalpas. This is what is meant by being aroused to the wisdom of former lives. This is what is meant by being aroused to the wisdom of former lives. So all this whole thing about former lives and having to build up this and doing that, and in a previous life I was this and here and there. Let that all go. That's what Kaizen is saying. There is being aroused to the wisdom of former lives. See the ocean. Work towards seeing that ocean, clarifying the ocean. And that becomes clear. It says, he keeps on saying, if you do not reach this dimension, you will be troubled by feelings about delusion and enlightenment. In other words, you fall back into duality, this wave or that wave. Is that wave enlightened? Is that the wave I want to ride? Or is it the delusional wave I want to ride? Yeah. You will be tossed around by the aspects of coming and going. And in the end, you will not understand that there is a true self. True self meaning the ocean. That there is a true self. You know. Nor will you clarify the fact that the fundamental mind can never be mistaken. The fundamental mind, again, in other words for ocean, that the fundamental mind can never be mistaken. Unavoidable. Unavoidable. It can never be mistaken. Mistakes are, this is a wave that is not right. This is a wave that is right. That's the mistake. But if you see the ocean, you don't have that. There is no right, no wrong. Therefore, you force the Buddhas to take pains to appear in the world. And you make the patriarch, the Bodhidharma, come all the way from the West. So we create our own confusion. And coming back to Unmon, killing it all. If I would have been there, I would have beaten him to death. You know, what a guy to be able to say that. You know, I would have beaten him to death. You know, but you can only say that when you see it very clearly. When you see Buddha. When you really need to see Buddha in order to be able to say that. Yeah. Therefore, you force the Buddhas to take pains to appear in the world. In other words, we create the image of a Buddha. We create what Buddha is like and not like. We categorize it. And when I say we, it's not just us. It's also all the schools and all the teachings and all the sutras and all of this here. This is all about categorizing and dividing. All of this stuff is all about that. Therefore, you force the Buddhas to take pains to appear in the world, and you make the patriarch Bodhidharma come all the way from the West. The original intention of the Buddhas appearing in the world and the original meaning of Bodhidharmas coming from the West was nothing but this. It's nothing but this. Yeah. And, you know, when you look at it from the ocean's perspective, there's only ever this. There's only ever this. You know, it's nothing but this. And no other thing than this. Like, this is like, it's like I alone. It's like the totality of existence. That's what you got to see. That the ocean is the totality of all of existence. That's this. The totality of all of existence. Yeah. You should take minute care and realize that this is truly mysterious and never obscured. Totally bright and never hidden, to know that intrinsically there exists the far superb light is called the wisdom of former lives. Today, also, I have a few humble words with which I would like to touch on this principle a little. Would you like to hear them? He says. And now comes Kaizen's verse, and Kaizen's verses are exquisite. They are so exquisite. So now he wrote the verse. Smashing the bodies that appeared separately in various former lives. I mean, one sentence. Smashing the bodies that appeared separately in former lives. All the concepts, everything that happened in the past. If I can smash that, get rid of it. Like that, and that's what we do when that's the function of our sitting, is to let it come. Let it go. Let it come. I'm smashing everything that is obstructing, which is my own beliefs and thoughts and concepts, smashing it. Yeah. So you imagine if you can smash. That's also the meaning of distinguishing all karma. Distinguishing all karma means smashing it all. You know, smashing it all. Smashing the bodies that appeared separately in various former lives. I now meet the old fella. I now meet him. Here he is.